This week, we're going to have Ben from Berkeley, who wrote a paper very recently with Anthony, who's also in the audience. So it's going to be very interesting. It's maybe a bit untypical for the strings seminar, but then it's quantum fields and strings. And so actually it fits quite well. And well, seminar is about anomalies and gravitational charge algebras, and Ben's going to fill us in on the details. So take it away.
Yeah, thanks. Thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure. So I'm going to tell you about some work that I did with Anthony that grew out of trying to understand this whole paradigm of boundary symmetries and charges in gravity, in particular for black holes, and the extent to which they could be related to the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy of the black hole. So this is kind of, this is an old story, and you've seen this in many different respects. So the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy is a very persistent object, and you can derive it from many different approaches. So there's, of course, the semi-classical path integral approach, where you do some sort of saddle point approximation, which lands you exactly on A over 4G. And then there are more microscopic computations of the black hole entropy, like the Strominger-Wafa result, which is a stringy sort of microstate counting. There's Strominger's other work, which sort of is the basis for a lot of the ideas in this talk, where you apply the Cardy formula to a 2D CFT, count the CFT microstates, and it gives you the entropy of a BTC black hole. And of course, there are many other approaches. There are approaches in quantum gravity and so on. All of them are good at giving you A over 4G. And because there's many different ways of getting the same answer that seem to not quite really care about the UV completion, at least this leading order result, it led Carlett to ask a very reasonable question. And that question is there some more universal description of the black hole microstates which maybe is able to get the answer without appealing to specific details of, say, the UV theory? And this, of course, would not be a UV description in and of itself. It would just be some sort of effective description of the microstate that's good enough to at least get the A over 4G. And what Carlett suggested is maybe the right thing to think about are symmetries of gravity, and in particular, symmetries of the horizon, if you think of the horizon as some sort of boundary of your space-time. So I'm going to just explain the basic ideas of what this sort of paradigm is, and then we'll get into the details as we go along. So Carlett's idea, and this idea has come up in many, many other papers since then. The idea is if you imagine you have a space-time with no boundaries, which is almost never the case, then all diffeomorphisms of the spacetime would be gauge symmetries. But when you actually do have boundaries, this is no longer the case. So the kind of boundaries we're interested in general are gravitational subregions. So for example, something like the black hole horizon or an entangling surface, if you're interested in computing entanglement entropy, many other examples. But basically, the sense in which you can think of gravitational subregions as boundaries in these cases is if you can imagine that these subregions are sort of like causal horizons for some space, for some observer in the exterior. And so it's sort of an effective space-time boundary for this exterior observer. You can sort of delete everything in the complement, and it wouldn't really matter to this observer. It's in this sense that you can think of this as a boundary. And when we say boundary, we really mean a fixed partition of the space-time. So you divide the space-time into two pieces, and this boundary is just a splitting of that that's held fixed. So because it's a fixed partition, diffeomorphisms, which preserve the boundary, are now physical symmetries. they're no longer just gauge transformations. They get promoted to genuine symmetries of the theory. And the sense in which they're physical is now there will be non-trivial surface charges, like non-zero charges associated to these diffeomorphisms. And these surface charges will now act non-trivially on the states, transform the states. This story is like very known to us if we think about what happens at infinity, with null infinity or spatial infinity. Diffeomorphisms that asymptote to the boundary give you non-zero charges, and these charges then actually transform the state. So the idea is these surface charges are codifying something about the boundary degrees of freedom living on whatever your boundary is. And Carlip's idea was maybe these boundary excitations could account for the entropy of a black hole, at least in some effective sense. And this is the idea that we're going to try and explore in this talk. So this idea was pursued by many different people in many different settings. And in most cases, what was considered were some sort of near horizon symmetries. And these near horizon symmetries seem to be good enough to determine the black hole entropy. So there's the original work by Strominger, which technically speaking isn't really a near horizon symmetry. These were studying symmetries of the ADS boundary. But then Carlip took that idea and then applied it to Killing horizons. And by studying certain symmetries of Killing horizons, was able to get the entropy of a black hole. And there are many other examples of this that I've listed out here. And most recently, some work by Lin Cheng and Anthony and collaborators, where this sort of idea was also extended to general axisymmetric Killing horizons. And in all of these cases, you get either one or two copies of a Virasoro algebra that appear at the horizon. And then you can compute the central extension of this algebra using canonical methods in gravity. And you sort of just assume that there's some dual two-dimensional CFT description of the horizon as just suggestive because there's a Virasoro algebra appearing. And then you just blindly apply the Cardy formula. You apply the Cardy formula and you see that you get area over 4G. And in all of these different papers, this algorithm is essentially the one that's always used, and it's always mysterious, but somehow you end up getting the correct answer. And this is essentially what seems like numerology. This is what Strominger likes to characterize it as, and I think that's a fair characterization, because you're basically just trying something, you follow your nose, you mix around some ingredients, and area over 4G seems to pop out. Who knows, like, it's not really clear why this works. And so there are certain issues that are present in these works, some of which are unique to some papers and others which show up in the other ones, but essentially the issues are there are various ambiguities in these constructions. And the ambiguities affect the entropy. You kind of just play around with them and sort of put in the answer by hand because you know you want to get area over 4G out. And resolving these ambiguities using some more well-defined principle is very important in order to put this on more concrete footing. And most of these works also use very restrictive boundary conditions. And I'll talk about this in a bit. But these restrictive boundary conditions also make it hard to describe this sort of derivation of the entropy from the Cardy formula from a more first principles approach. And finally, the whole thing just seems like magic. And this is true for all of these papers. It just completely seems like magic that any of this works. And the goal of this talk is to hopefully try and resolve these issues, perhaps to some extent with the exception of this issue that it seems like magic. We'll talk about that later. Using this covariant phase-space formalism. So this tool will be very helpful in making this whole procedure slightly more rigorous and hopefully putting it on more solid footing. So because there's like a zoo of many different symmetries that have been considered for the black hole, it's important for us to really make concrete exactly what setup we're trying to consider. So let me just do that now. Our goal at the end of the day is to calculate the algebra of gravitational charges that appear on the horizon of a black hole. And from this algebra, extract the central extension, this K quantity. The central extension will be what's responsible for the entropy through the Cardy formula. So a lot of these constructions that I just mentioned, they impose extremely strong boundary conditions at the horizon. And these boundary conditions essentially amount to giving the horizon the interpretation as an actual physical barrier in the space-time, which is not very natural because we're just trying to understand the degrees of freedom that are describing gravitational subregions. Subregions aren't really real places in your space-time. So what we really want to do is think about this boundary as just some arbitrary partition of space-time, including the horizon. We don't want to be imposing boundary conditions at the horizon that make it look like it's an actual physical object. So this is an important part. And the only work that really accommodates a situation where you don't have to impose very restrictive boundary conditions is this work by Hocko, Hocking, Perry, and Strominger, where they construct a class of Virasoro symmetries which with charges that you can define without imposing any strong boundary conditions. The flip side of this is the charges that they use are non-integrable charges, meaning there's some flux of the system and the system is not closed. So we don't have a closed system, you can't get integrable charges. And I'll describe that, what I mean by that, in more detail in a second. But the fact that we have to deal with these non-integrable charges will end up being an important part of making this whole construction more concrete. So let me just describe now the sort of three main ingredients that we need in order to codify this whole framework. So the thing that we're going to use is the covariant phase space formalism for general relativity. In particular, we're going to consider general relativity with some null boundary. And there are three particular issues that we have to resolve that all stem from the fact we have to deal with non-integrable charges. The first is, if you have non-integrable charges, the next best thing to do is to talk about quasi-local charges. These are charges that are just associated to some co-dimension 2 surface when you have an open system. And as you evolve that co-dimension 2 surface in time, the charges will change because of flux. But defining quasi-local charges in gravity has ambiguities in it, as we will see. And these ambiguities can affect the final result for the entropy. So we need some way of trying to fix these ambiguities. The other thing is, normally when we talk about a bracket for charges, we talk about the Poisson bracket. We have quasi-local charges for an open system, that Poisson bracket doesn't make sense anymore. And so you need some notion of an algebra that works in the case of an open system. And lastly, we need to understand how to characterize the symplectic potential on a null boundary in the absence of restrictive boundary conditions, because the terms in the symplectic potential will tell us about things like the flux and the boundary term in the gravitational action, and this will play an important role in understanding where the central charge comes from. So once these ingredients are in place, we can just put it together and plug and chug and try to understand how the Cardy formula captures the entropy of a black hole for these particular Virasoro symmetries, which I will describe later. So this is the basic setup. And now I'll just go through each of these issues in turn and put these ingredients together. Now, before I get to that, there's an interpretation that I want you to keep in the back of your mind that I'm going to try to emphasize in multiple places. The intent is to clarify the nature of this central charge and how it compares with the things that we're already used to in ADS-CFT. So the theme is that the central charge is arising from some sort of anomaly. And this particular case is an anomaly associated to diffeomorphisms. As we'll see later, in the particular case that we care about for a null surface like the horizon, the anomaly comes from fixing what we call a scaling frame. So essentially, if you have a normal for a null surface, the normal doesn't have a preferred normalization. You can rescale the null normal and nothing changes. So a choice of normalization or choice of this scale corresponds to fixing a particular frame. And as we'll see later, the central charge arises because an anomaly gets introduced from fixing the scaling frame. And it's exactly like in ADS-DFT where we fix a wireframe on the boundary. And in the Brown-Hanau type calculations, fixing the wireframe is what breaks the diffeomorphism symmetry and introduces some kind of anomaly. And the theme here is that there are all these different symmetry algebras that were considered by people, and they all seem to give the Cardy formula, and it seems mysterious. Maybe the right thing to talk about, or think about rather, is really this anomaly and the role that the anomaly is playing with respect to the Cardy formula. And hopefully this clarifies this whole magic of cardiology. So I'll start now with the issue of quasi-local charges for open systems. So like I said, the tool we're gonna use is this covariant phase-based formalism, which has come up in many different respects, especially in recent years. And the particular ones that we kind of built off of are the ones by Lee and Wald, Ironwald, and many other iterations with Wald in it. And I'm just gonna briefly describe the relevant elements that are needed for our analysis. So the covariant phase-based formalism involves a specification of both kinematics and dynamics. The kinematics is essentially just a configuration space of metrics on some manifold, and this manifold is gonna have some boundary n. And then what you do is you project onto the metrics that solve the equations of motion, and various subtleties aside, this is sort of the procedure you follow in order to get the covariant phase space. This phase space has a gauge symmetry associated to it. In this particular case, it's diffeomorphism invariance, where you can shift G by the Lie derivatives along some vector fields. And typically, if you have a manifold with boundary and you're trying to specify the configuration space, you also tend to impose certain boundary conditions on the metric at the boundary n. And you should think of this as some sort of partial gauge fixing of the metric in the presence of this boundary. And we'll talk a little later about what kind of gauge fixings are allowed in our case and what kind of gauge fixings are not allowed. And the whole point of this is to be as minimal as possible when it comes to these partial gauge fixings. So a very quick crash course on the necessary like ingredients for the covariant phase-based formalism. So we have this object called the presymplectic potential, which will play an important role. And this is essentially just the boundary term and the variation of the Lagrangian. So you take a variation of the Lagrangian, you get the equations of motion, and then you get this total derivative term. This is called the presymplectic potential. There's also the Noether charge. So Noether's theorem gives us some sort of current associated to diffeomorphisms. This current is closed, so there is a conserved charge associated to it, and this is this object Q. And lastly, there's the presymplectic form, which is just given by an integral of the exterior derivative of the symplectic potential in field space. So these three are the main objects that kind of give everything else. So in particular, we can define linearized charges corresponding to diffeomorphisms by taking the symplectic form, which depends on two different variations of the metric, and just allowing one of the variations to be given by a diffeomorphism along some vector field. And you can play around with properties of the symplectic form, and there's a neat formula for what it is in terms of the Noether charge and the symplectic potential, and it localizes to a boundary term. So if sigma is some spatial slice in your spacetime, then the linearized charge is just going to localize to the boundary of this spatial slice. Now, I put a question mark here, and this question mark is important because in general, you can't actually integrate up this equation in field space, get rid of the delta on the left-hand side, and get an actual integrable charge H if you use this definition of it. And this is essentially because in most cases, you don't have a closed system. There's going to be flux leaking into your system. And because there's flux leaking in, if you only have access to a subset of the degrees of freedom, you won't have enough information to integrate up the charge and get something integrable. So this is okay at the linearized level, but it's not exactly what we want, because we want to talk about actual charges on the entire field space. So that's where I'm going to come to now. So like I said, if you take this symplectic potential and you pull it back to the null surface, you can break it up into three pieces. There's a boundary term, a corner term, and a flux term. And you can see that if this flux term is non-zero, then this formula here for delta H is not going to turn into a total variation. The flux term is going to obstruct that. So you won't be able to integrate up the charge. Now, the way to get around this is to not define the charges through this relation. It's to instead talk about a manifestly integrable quasi-local charge given by this formula here. And this thing was talked about in an old paper by Walden Zupas, and to some extent also talked about more recently by Harlow and Wu, where you basically take the Noether charge and then you add on the boundary term in the symplectic potential and the corner term. Essentially, all you're doing is moving the boundary term and corner term to one side with the symplectic potential, and you're just stripping off the flux by hand. So just by hand stripping off the flux. And so this defines our quasi-local charges. And the reason this L, this curly L, is called a boundary term is if you look at the variational principle defined for this open region U, then if you take a variation of the Lagrangian, this boundary term has to be included in order to get the equations of motion in the bulk, as well as the appropriate contributions from the boundary N. In the case of ADS-CFT, for example, this curly L would just be the Gibbons Hawking York boundary term. But in more general cases, there's a specific case-by-case expression for this L. And this boundary term will play an important role in the central extension, as we'll see. Okay, so are there any questions so far? All right. Now, if you look at this expression, it's pretty clear. Sorry, was there a question?
Just a question. I mean, I guess you're going to explain what criteria you use to isolate what you call the flux, right?
That's exactly my next slide. Yeah, thanks. Okay, so if you look at this, it's clear that there's no unique notion in which there's a flux and a boundary term. You can sort of shift things around between these various terms and change what you call the flux and what you call the boundary term. So this is the main ambiguity in defining these quasi-local charges. And we would like some way of fixing what this flux term is so that we have a more principled approach to extracting the boundary term. And there are possibly different principles that are relevant. The one that we thought would be the most sensible is to impose what we call the Dirichlet form of the flux. So this is a form where you have the conjugate momentum, pi ij, appearing with the variation of the intrinsic metric of the surface. So this essentially resolves the ambiguity in specifying the flux, up to some minor caveats, but these caveats will not be relevant for the computation of the central charge, so I won't really discuss them. We could talk about it in the end. But the motivation for this Dirichlet form of the flux is the following. One thing is, in this form, you can clearly interpret the conjugate momentum as a stress tensor if you follow something similar to the Brown-York approach, where you have a conjugate momentum appearing alongside an induced variation of an induced metric, and then you just strip off that conjugate momentum as the stress tensor. The other thing is it's pretty well motivated by holography. So in holography, what we usually do is we have this, if we didn't know anything about boundary conditions, this curly E would appear in this form. We would impose Dirichlet boundary conditions at the ADS boundary. And that's the way we usually define things like the extrapolate dictionary. And the Dirichlet boundary condition in the ADS case is very important for example, even the original Brown-Hanau analysis of getting the boundary central charge of the CFT from a gravitational charge algebra. So you might imagine that the same principle should also apply when talking about finite boundaries in a more general gravitational setting. And perhaps a slightly more concrete argument in favor of Dirichlet is the following. Let's say you want to do a gluing problem. So you split your space-time into two pieces. You have a subregion U, and then you have a complementary subregion U bar with associated boundaries N and N bar. And you want to glue them together to get a single space-time. And you glue it together using the path integral. If you take the if you do the variational principle for this gluing problem, then there are two different, there are two examples of what you can do. The first is you do the Dirichlet form of the flux, where you would match the induced metric, the intrinsic metric, between N and N bar. And if you do that, then the variational principle gives you the difference between the conjugate momenta of the region and its complement. And in this case, if you do a path integral, then the off-shell configurations would have conjugate momenta that differ between N and N bar when you glue them together. So there would be a jump in the conjugate momentum across the boundary after you do the gluing. But this is okay. We're okay with having jumps for example, in the extrinsic curvature. That's not really a problem. On the other hand, if you do something like Neumann, where instead of having a flux in the form that we described, you have, for example, Gij delta pi ij, then kinematically you would match the pi ij's between the two subregions. But now, when you do the path integral, you're going to have off-shell configurations where the intrinsic metric is not matched between the two boundaries. So there can be a discontinuity in the intrinsic metric. And this is not a good thing to do, even if you have off-shell configurations, because these aren't simple things like conical singularities, which are okay. This would be a distributionally ill-defined metric that would give rise to, again, distributionally ill-defined curvatures. So just geometrically, it's not a good thing to do. So it seems like from the perspective of the matching problem, when you like the gluing for the path integral, it seems like a Dirichlet condition is more preferred. So for all of these reasons, we are going to proceed by fixing this particular form of the flux.
Just a question, maybe you're going again to address that, but what you just described is good if you have a time-like surface, but for a null surface, the induced metric is not enough, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
there's an extra ambiguity there in what you call the...
Yeah, so for an induced metric, the null generator will also kind of be an intrinsic quantity, and that'll also show up. But I think the argument is based, this argument would basically be the same thing, but instead of just talking about Gij, you would also talk about the null generator of the null surface. Yeah, so I'll talk about that. So I sort of mentioned earlier that the idea here is we want to think about the central charges coming from some sort of anomaly. And I've been calling this curly E thing a flux. And the sense in which it's a flux, as we saw earlier, is it's sort of the obstruction to the integrability of the Hamiltonian. There's another sense in which it's the flux, a slightly more familiar sense. So if you take the null, if you take your boundary, in this case, it's a null surface, and you take two different cross sections of the null surface, S1 and S2, and you compute the difference in the charges between these two cross sections, you can derive a sort of continuity equation, which says the difference in the charges is equal to the integral of the flux between the two cross sections. except in this case, we get an extra term. So the first term is just the flux, but there's this additional term that shows up. So this additional term is given in terms of this delta of xi, which is which you can think of as an anomaly operator. And this was first talked about, in as far as we know, in this paper by Florian and Laurent. This operator measures the extent to which the thing it's acting on doesn't transform covariantly under diffeomorphisms. So in the particular case that we have, where you have an anomaly, the anomaly operator acting on the boundary term L, if you write out what it is, it's basically measuring the transformation of the boundary term under field space diffeomorphisms, minus the transformation of the boundary term under space-time diffeomorphisms. And if this is non-zero, then we say that the boundary term transforms anomalously. So if you look at this continuity equation, there's an anomalous contribution to it that's preventing it from being completely satisfied because of the boundary term transforming anomalously. And in this sense, you can think of it as pretty similar to what happens in quantum field theory, where if you have an anomaly, then you end up getting anomalous Ward identities for conserved currents. This is very similar to that. And we'll see in a second how this delta of L is also responsible for the central charge. So what I'll come to now is talk about the charge algebra. So as I mentioned earlier, we're dealing with an open, as we'll see, I guess I haven't quite shown you yet, but the kind of symmetries that we'll be interested in eventually will not give you integrable charges, right? So that's why we have to talk about these quasi-local charges. And because these are quasi-local charges, their bracket is not going to be a Poisson bracket. Poisson bracket really only makes sense for a closed system. So we need a way to compute the bracket of these charges. And one way to do it was proposed in this paper by Barnage and Tressert when they were studying null infinity. The idea is when you compute the bracket, you have the usual term that shows up. So if you have a charge for xi and some charge for another vector field zeta, and you have the variation of the charge of one vector field with respect to the other, but you also add in this flux term. So you compute the integral of the flux on the codimension 2 surface that you're interested in.
Sorry, is there a typo? Is there a typo in your formula?
Like oh, sorry. I think there is a typo. The first, it should be Li of zeta. Sorry. Yeah, there is a typo. Thanks. So that should be Li of zeta there. And so this is just a proposal for what the modified bracket should be, but the sense in which this really is a good notion of a bracket is if you then you can check that it reproduces the diffeomorphism algebra up to a central extension. So you can check that this bracket gives you back H of the commutator of the two vector fields plus a possible central extension. And I want to emphasize again that this is not a Poisson bracket because it knows about this flux term, right? So the whole point is we have to add on this flux term to define this bracket. And in this form, this is not exactly the form that'll be useful to us. What you can do is play around with the different expressions involved and derive an explicit formula for the central charge based on this definition of this modified bracket. And you get something that's pretty nice. The explicit, like, details of this aren't so important, but the point is the central charge just ends up coming from the anomalous transformation of the boundary term under the boundary diffeomorphisms. And this is, again, I want to stress, very similar to what happens in ADS-CFT. In that case, you have a holographic Weyl anomaly. And what happens is you can choose different radial cutoffs of ADS in the limit to the asymptotic boundary. And the non-covariance of the radial cutoff under diffeomorphisms, as it appears in the boundary term, is what gives rise to the holographic Weyl anomaly. So it's a very similar story here.
Ben, can I ask a quick question?
Yes, please.
Maybe I'm overinterpreting what you said, but you mentioned that sort of one choice of bracket you could choose is this Barnage Trussard bracket. Does that mean that it's not necessarily unique, or if there's other choices, could you get something else out of this?
That's a good question. So as far as I know, at least I can't think of in any other sensible way to define this bracket. This is basically the only thing you can imagine writing down. I just meant I don't know of a uniqueness theorem for it. I don't know of a sense in which this is the only possible thing you could write down. But it's certainly the most natural thing.
Okay.
I don't even know if there is much freedom in modifying this and getting something that's still sensible.
All right.
It has to, because the important thing is it has to reproduce the diffeomorphism algebra, and it's a pretty strong constraint on what it can be.
Can I ask a question? Is it clear that it satisfies Jacobi?
Yeah, you can check that it satisfies Jacobi.
So that's presumably where your constraints comes from.
Yeah, Jacobi. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So this analogy with ADS-EFT, I'm going to make it much more explicit in a little bit. So for right now, it's just sort of a motivation just to keep in mind the story seems to be very, very parallel. Okay. So the last thing is the nitty gritty of the actual expressions that we need. So I'm going to have to now talk about the actual field space that we're interested in and what the symplectic potential and so on are. So at the outset, what we're dealing with is general relativity with some null boundary. So our field space just consists of a set of all possible metrics on some manifold and with some fixed boundary. The order of the steps in specifying the field space is as follows. I just give you some boundary. This boundary has some normal associated to it. And I haven't said anything about the metric yet. So this normal is specified independently of the metric. And so the variation of the normal, it's very natural to just take it to be zero. So we're just going to fix the variation of the normal to be zero. Then, of course, we want this to eventually be a null surface. So we're going to dynamically impose that the surface is null. And by that, I just mean, having fixed the null normal, how do we make sure that the boundary is null across field space? We just impose this particular condition on the metric that twice contracted with the null generator, it just vanishes. You can check that this is good enough for the surface to be null. The important point here is the fact that we're not allowing the scaling frame or like the normalization of L to fluctuate across field space is really where the anomaly comes from, as we'll see. So it's the fact that we're not allowing L to fluctuate in field space under diffeomorphisms, at least the scaling of it. But spacetime diffeomorphisms do want to change the normalization of L. So it's this discord that will give rise to the anomaly. Now, you might ask, why are we being so minimal with the boundary conditions? And there's a practical reason for it and a slightly more principled reason. The practical reason is if you had imposed anything stronger, it just would not be compatible with the Virasoro symmetries that we're eventually interested in. They just won't preserve the conditions. And whatever boundary conditions we impose, on the metric, it's important that the vector fields satisfy those boundary conditions on the metric. So we can't impose anything stronger on the metric. More importantly, any more boundary conditions you do impose would kill actual physical excitations on the null boundary, because they would all correspond to non-degenerate directions of the symplectic form. So if you were to do any more partial gauge fixing, you would inadvertently be killing important degrees of freedom. And if you're interested in how these degrees of freedom might be important for entropy, you really shouldn't be doing that. So we're just going to stick to this minimal setup. Now, you could imagine introducing additional non-metric related degrees of freedom, but since this is really all you're given when you specify a null surface, we were just going to stick to this minimal set. Okay, so some formulas now. The starting point is the actual expression for the symplectic potential. So in vacuum general relativity, there's a very nice expression for it in terms of variations of Christoffel symbols. The details of this aren't so important, really. The main thing is, as we said earlier, what you do is you decompose the symplectic potential into different components. There's a boundary term, a corner term, and then there's this flux piece. So notice now, okay, so this is in Dirichlet form. It's not quite what I wrote earlier, and that's because on a null surface, there's sort of two intrinsic quantities. There's the induced metric, Gij, and there's also the null generator. The null generator for a null surface is also intrinsic. So you get two pieces for the flux. But both of them are Dirichlet in the sense that I was explaining earlier in spirit. Their expressions aren't super important right now. The important thing is the boundary term, because that's what's important for the central charge. And the boundary term that we find is simply given by the inaffinity of the null generators. So just to remind you, the inaffinity just measures the extent to which the null generators fail to be affinely parameterized. And eta here is just the induced volume element on the null surface. This particular boundary term has appeared in various contexts in the past. There's a paper by Rob and collaborators where this kind of term was written down when studying complexity, and some other earlier works as well. So all these works use this Dirichlet form of the flux, so it's not surprising that the boundary terms all end up being the same. Now, let me just note one thing. So you can, you know, we work out explicitly what pi ij and pi I are, and you can use that to construct, for example, a Brown-York stress tensor on the null surface. Okay, so now that we have the boundary term, our next course of action is just to figure out what the anomaly of the boundary term is. So if you have any vector field which preserves your null surface or preserves your boundary, and by preserve, I just mean that it doesn't, you know, move the boundary around, it's tangent to the boundary, then you can work out a simple relationship for how the null normal transforms under diffeomorphism. It just picks up a rescaling, and let's just call this rescaling W. So because the variation of the null normal is always fixed to be zero in our setup, you can just apply the anomaly operator to the null normal, and it's completely specified by this rescaling parameter coming from the diffeomorphism, so this W quantity. And all other anomalous transformations of quantities that appear are entirely determined by this W. So in particular, you can go ahead and work out what the anomalous transformation of this particular boundary term is that comes from the inaffinity, and it has a very simple expression. It's just given by the derivative of this W quantity, this rescaling, along the null generator. And the name of the game now is to consider killing horizons and just evaluate what this anomaly is. Any questions so far? Okay. So before I get to that, I'm just going to give a slightly more explicit or concrete like analogy with ADS-CFT. So we talked about how the anomaly is coming from fixing this frame for the null generator or the null normal. You can think of it as a scaling frame or a boost frame, whichever terminology you like better. But it's essentially just coming from not allowing the normalization of the null normal to fluctuate. Another way to think about a null surface is that it's the limit of a sequence of stretched horizons. Let's call this sequence of stretched horizons X. Then in this case, the null generator is just going to be given by the derivative of this stretched horizon specification, since it's some level set of it. And there are many different stretched horizons that you can choose that all whose sequence all limits to the null surface. So you can reparameterize a stretched horizon to some other stress horizon, X tilde, which is a function of the original one, but also is pointwise deformed with respect to some other set of coordinates, XI. And if you do this reparameterization of the stretched horizons using this pointwise deformations, then the null normal rescales by a pointwise function on the null surface. So you can reinterpret the freedom in the normalization of the null normal is just the ability to choose different stretched horizons that limit to the null surface. And this is, again, very similar to what happens in ADS-CFT, where you have different possible choices of radial cutoff. And if you take the limit of the different radial cutoffs to infinity using the conformal completion, this corresponds to choosing different while frames on the boundary. And since it's the like fixing of the while frame that gives rise to the anomaly, it's very analogous to the stretched horizon picture that's happening here. So instead of a radial cutoff, you sort of had a time-like membrane cutoff that approaches the horizon. Okay, so this has all been general up till now. And now we're just going to restrict to an actual killing horizon and work out what the actual expressions are so we can just use the Cardy formula. So in particular, what we're going to do is restrict to axisymmetric killing horizons in arbitrary dimensions. So the original setup of HHPS was for four-dimensional Kerr black holes. But there was this paper by Lin Cheng and Anthony and some students at PI where they generalized this to arbitrary axisymmetric killing horizons. And in this setup, we're going to take the null generator to be the horizon killing vector. And we're just going to take our codimension two surface sigma to be the bifurcation surface. So in this case, again, none of the details are super important here, but you can write the near horizon metric in a Rindler-like form. And once you write the metric in this Rindler form, you can define these conformal coordinates, which transform the metric into a form that has an ADS3 factor in it. So that's these W plus W minus coordinates. And phi is a periodically identified coordinate. So what you end up getting is a problem where you have to consider now the vector fields which preserve this ADS3 factor with this periodically identified coordinate phi. So that's what these HHPS symmetries are. So you can just work out what are the vector fields which preserve this ADS3 factor. And they take this general form. These vector fields, so there's two classes of vector fields. There's Xi and Xi bar. Xi are the vector fields which are well defined for the future horizon. Xi bar are the vector fields which are well defined for the past horizon. And because the coordinates are periodically identified in phi, you can expand these vector fields in modes and compute their Lie bracket, and you find a diff S1 cross diff S1 algebra. So you get two copies of them, one for the future horizon vector fields and another set for the past horizon vector fields, more or less. And now, I mean, since we have these vector fields, we can now just go ahead and compute the central extension because we know what the boundary term is. We can just apply that to a killing horizon. We know what the vector fields are now. So we can just plug in chug, apply the anomaly operator to the boundary term and just work out what k is. And if you work it all out, you find that you get the diff S1 cross diff S1 algebra essentially extended to a Virasoro cross Virasoro algebra with equal central charges for C and C bar. So the C and C bar central charges are the exact same and they're fixed by the area of the black hole and these parameters alpha and beta, which up until now, just to emphasize, have just been some parameters that showed up in the coordinate transformation. So there's some alpha here and there's some beta here. And they just happen to appear in the central charge. Okay. So we've systematically derived this now using the various principles that we've set out to fix the ambiguities. And now we can look at this slightly more carefully. So this gravitational charge algebra for this black hole looks a lot like the right moving and left moving sectors of some 2D CFT, right? So there's a resemblance. So let's just apply the Cardy formula like all the people who have done in the past and just see what happens. The first thing is we need to know what the left and right temperatures are. Thankfully, this was done in this paper by HHPS, where they showed that by studying properties of the vacuum near the horizon, they showed that the temperature, the right moving temperature is given by alpha and the left moving temperature is given by beta. So now we can just take our formula for C and C bar that we got earlier, plug in these temperatures, and apply the canonical Cardy formula. And funny enough, what we find is the canonical Cardy formula gives you twice the entropy of a black hole. So instead of just getting the entropy of a black hole, we get twice the entropy, which is very funny. Now, the first thing you might ask is, did we make a mistake? Maybe we dropped a factor of two somewhere. And we're sure that we didn't make a mistake. This factor of two is genuinely there. So you might now ask, okay, where is this factor of two coming from? If it's genuinely meant to be there, then where is it? So we had a conjecture for where it might be coming from. The conjecture is as follows. So let's say you wanted to think about the setup using a gluing type construction. So we're interested in the bifurcation surface of a two-sided black hole with a Killing horizon. One way to build up the interior of the black hole is to imagine that you have two different codimension two surfaces that describe their respective left and right regions, sigma L and sigma R, and you glue them together, glue the two red dots together to get the bifurcation surface that builds up the interior. So here we've depicted like two stretched horizons, which you're supposed to imagine eventually approach the respective black hole horizons. And then you glue across the bifurcation surface. And the picture that we usually have in mind for this kind of setup is that you have some edge modes living on these respective boundaries that end up being maximally entangled with each other after you glue them. And that is what gives rise to the interior. So there's two copies of edge modes. And if you now imagine there's a CFT associated to each of these edge modes, then you get two entangled CFTs. And it's possible that this bracket, this Barnett-Chaussert bracket that we're talking about, because we have an open system, it's possible that this bracket is actually computing the central charge of this combined system of CFTs. So if you do the thermal Cardy calculation, so you have a global thermal state for these two CFTs, you would just get twice the black hole entropy if the bracket was really sensitive to both of the CFTs. But if you traced out one of the CFTs, then the entropy would just give you back area over 4G. Now, this is just a conjecture for how this bracket might be behaving. And we don't have direct evidence for it, but what I'll describe now is sort of some indirect evidence for it in a situation where instead of an open system where we have to use the BT bracket, we just use the Poisson bracket. And I'll show you that in that case, the entropy does get halved. Are there any questions on this before I move on to that?
Yeah, actually, the thing I'm a bit confused about is that it seems like in your construction, you're choosing a particular boundary condition at the horizon, so in particular, like at the say future horizon. So it seems like if I take two copies and I want to glue them together, I still would need to do this twice, and I would get an overall factor of four. But maybe I'm thinking too simplistic about that. Right. So like I mean, you give the horizon on the left and a second like future horizon on the right side, as seen from like each of these wedges. So
you're saying the count. So I think if I understand what you're saying correctly, then factor of two would have come from like the fact that we have contributions from both a future horizon and a past horizon. And you're saying including them twice give you a factor of four.
Yeah. Like I didn't mean to say the first thing that it would come from like having the future and the past horizon. I'm just saying you get a factor of two for doing the calculation on one side and saying I have one black hole that'll I can pass through the horizon. And now you have like here, you have something that looks like having two black holes, right? Which get glued together at the bifurcated horizon at the end of the day, but in the meantime, you have two. Why didn't you get a factor of four then, like two times two?
Yeah, but so there's just one CFT associated to the one black hole and one CFT associated to the other black hole. And the I think like the idea is that the bracket might be computing the central charge of the two CFTs combined. So it's not to say that this bracket is just computing the central charge of this one, like the right wedge. And then I'm not saying that you then add that central charge to the central charge of the left wedge, because then I could imagine getting something like 4. The claim is that maybe the bracket is at the very start already computing the central charge of these of the CFTs associated to these two wedges.
Yeah, okay. Maybe we can talk about this later after the talk. So,
okay. All right.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay. So let me now give a bit of contrasting situation, which maybe like, you know, gives a bit of evidence in favor of this proposal. So if we instead have an algebra of integrable charges, then the algebra should not be including anything in some complementary region with some complement edgemont. If you have integrable charges and you just have a regular Poisson bracket, the Poisson bracket can just be defined in the usual way for whatever your subsystem is. Everything should just go through it without any funny business. Now, in general, the charges that we've been talking about are not integrable. But something that was explained in this earlier paper is that there's some very special values of the temperatures, alpha and beta, for which the charges do become integrable. And something that we considered in this is like the conditions for these temperatures such that you get integrable charges. And let's say now we have fixed the temperatures to have these special values and the charges are integrable for these special values. Then in this case, as I said, the Barnes-Tressert bracket reduces to the Poisson bracket. And because we have a Poisson bracket, we can just directly compute the central charges C and C bar from the symplectic form in the usual way. Now, if you compute it this way, and then you compare this the central charges computed from the symplectic form with our general formula for the central charge, then you see that the two of them agree only if the boundary term gets halved. And if you halve the boundary term, then you get the correct entropy of the black hole from the Cardy formula. And moreover, because we have a closed system now, we can also apply the microcanonical Cardy formula for an ensemble at a fixed energy. And you can work out what the L0 and L0 bar generators are and just plug into the microcanonical formula. And if you use this halved boundary term again, you get area over 4G. So when you use the integrable generators in the case of a closed system, it rearranges the boundary term in a way that gives you the right entropy. So there's two ways to interpret this. One is it's consistent with our picture that when you have an open system and you have to use the BT bracket, that it's sort of counting the entropy, the central charge of the edge modes and their complement, but in the closed case, it isn't. Or that the Dirichlet principle that we used is maybe not the right principle. And for some reason, you're supposed to use this halved boundary term from the very start, even for the non-integrable case. But it's not really clear what that principle would be. It's certainly not anywhere near as natural as the Dirichlet condition, but it's a possibility. Maybe there's some way to argue that this is the right principle, but I don't necessarily see how. Okay, so just to summarize what we've done so far, we have this, so there are ambiguities in the covariant phase space formalism for constructing these quasi-local charges, and we used this Dirichlet flux condition in order to fix this ambiguity. And having fixed this, we got a central charge that came from the anomaly in the boundary term associated to fixing a particular scaling frame for the null normal. And we drew analogies with the situation in ADS-CFT where the Weyl anomaly comes from fixing a particular Weyl frame or a particular radial cutoff. And the main message of this talk is that maybe it's the anomaly that's really what's important, not the specific symmetry algebras. So for example, you could ask a very natural question, which is if you have a higher dimensional black hole and you really want to think of some sort of subregion holography, why should the boundary theory be a 2D CFT? It doesn't seem like what we would expect. And so the point is that the 2D CFT came about because we were interested in the Virasoro generators. But maybe the specific symmetry algebras are not really what's important. What's important is there's this anomaly that's showing up. And maybe there's a more natural way to describe the near horizon region without appealing to this two-dimensional reduction. And the anomaly is still what gives you the correct entropy. But then you would need some notion of a Cardy formula that works in a case where you don't have a 2D CFT. There's some work on this for the torus partition function, but as far as I know, it hasn't really been generalized to a broader variety of cases. So the other thing is we found that the Cardy formula applied to this central charge gave twice the black hole entropy. And we gave a potential conjecture for, you know, how this factor of two might come about in terms of entangled edge modes. And gave some evidence for this by contrasting it with what happens in the integrable case where you just use the Poisson bracket and not this funny bracket. And the microcanonical Cardy formula ends up giving you the correct entropy. So with that all in place, I just want to mention a couple of things which I think are worth thinking about, you know, moving forward with regards to these things. So the first one is obviously what is this factor of two coming from? We had this conjecture for it, but in order to really solidify that, one would need a first principles derivation of this BT bracket. And maybe the right way to think about that is to consider something like a gluing construction between the subregion of interest and its complement and trying to understand how the BT bracket might come about from a Poisson bracket in this enlarged phase space that includes the subregion and the auxiliary system where the degrees of freedom that are leaking out through the flux get absorbed into. The other thing is whether we can use this construction to then understand how to compute central charges for more general things than just stationary black holes. And related to this is understanding what exactly these Virasoro symmetries are geometrically. We just sort of wrote down some coordinate system with this ADS3 factor near the horizon, but an understanding of it from a more dynamical point of view in terms of, say, boundary conditions in the phase space would be nice. But perhaps most importantly, the real question is, why does any of this work at all? So that was sort of part of the magic that I was describing at the start of this whole thing. And to some extent, it still seems magical. Why the Cardy formula works so well. And hopefully this picture in terms of the scaling anomaly sheds light on that. But there's still an important piece of this which has not been resolved. In the original ADS CFT case, the Cardy formula is derived on the boundary CFT by using modular invariants. You know, and we're not using any of that here. We're just assuming that the Cardy formula can be applied. But in order to really make it concrete, one would need some analog of modular invariants for the horizon. And I'm not really sure what that would entail or how one would go about figuring that out, but essentially one would need to identify some set of large diffeomorphisms that act on the horizon that discretely identify different configurations in a way that resembles modular invariants. And so obviously that would be something important to work out to see to what extent this whole thing is a self-contained approach and it's actually telling you something about where the black hole entropy is coming from in terms of boundary degrees of freedom. So thank you. Stop there.
Well, all right. So thanks a lot, Ben, for this very nice talk. Yeah, I think it's a good time now to seize the opportunity to ask questions. Yeah, let me maybe, since I don't see anyone speaking up or having their hand up, I was curious whether, so the whole framework you described is very general, right? Just based on the covariant phase space formalism. So did you ever look at like higher curvature corrections do you know of people who look at higher curvature corrections and does the entropy formula extend like correctly?
That's a very good question. So as far as I know, no one has really worked this out properly for higher curvature gravity. Part of the thing is that the like ambiguities get a lot more complicated when you have higher curvature corrections. I'm not really sure if this, for example, this Dirichlet condition would be exactly the most appropriate thing in higher curvature theories, where the kind of terms you can add get more complicated. But these corner terms that we were talking about earlier, if you look at what the corner terms look like for higher curvature gravity, they kind of have the right flavor to look like Dong corrections. And one thing that's lacking is a covariant phase space derivation of the Dong formula. So one thing that would be very nice is if by playing around with the ambiguities in this prescription and by looking at the corner term in particular, you could somehow reproduce the Dong entropy. But yeah, I don't know if the central charge approach itself would be able to reproduce that.
Okay. Yeah. Cool. All right. Are there any other questions? Laurent, yeah.
Yeah, I have a question about this. Have you thought a little bit more about the meaning of this Banach bracket at the quantum level? In the sense that, you know, what would it mean? Somehow you're saying you have an open system, which means a priori you don't have a closed system interpretation, but then somehow there's these Banach brackets suggest there's some kind of closed system interpretation of open systems.
What, yeah. You know,
and you're suggesting it just might be a doubling of the original one. Is there, you know, does that ring with, sounds very interesting.
Yeah. At the quantum level, I mean, the picture basically seems like what you would, it seems like the bracket would be implementing some sort of algebra for the extended Hilbert space construction. That's the first thing that comes to my mind, where you have the edge modes and their associated complementary edge modes. And somehow the way you should really be thinking about this bracket is it's measuring. Oh, okay. Let me say it this way. Let's say you decomposed your phase space into a bunch of smaller phase spaces, each of which corresponded to a fixed Dirichlet boundary condition. So you have many different sub phase spaces of fixed Dirichlet boundary condition. Then what's happening here is because you have an open system, you're somehow able to go between these different fixed Dirichlet boundary conditions. Like, we're not actually imposing that you have Dirichlet boundary conditions, so you can sort of move between them using some symplectic transformation. So at the quantum level, I think this bracket is some algebra that is taking you from a block if you block decompose your state into fixed area eigenstates, then the bracket somehow is allowing you to go between the different like area eigenstate blocks. But I don't really have a great picture of how that would come about or how to see that more concrete. Mm-hmm. I don't know if Anthony is still here, but maybe he can say more on this if he has some idea of it.
I think that's essentially the picture I would have in mind. It's just this idea that you decompose a state into super selection sectors, and some of these symmetries that we are considering ought to be something that just maps you between super selection sectors. So it's only super selected if you restrict to a subregion and a set of transformations that respect Dirichlet, but you could assume on the bigger global phase space, there's transformations that mix you between the sectors. So
yeah.